Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Margarete Grantner. I'm a historian from the University of Vienna. And let me begin my moderation of this evening by expressing our gratitude to the people who organized this meeting tonight, and first of all, our gratitude to Mr. Binder, who was absolutely instrumental in doing this. Thank you very much. It is a pleasure and a great honor for me to moderate this evening and to introduce you to the lecture given tonight by Professor John Boyer. Some of you must know that he is the Dean of the College of the University of Chicago. Some of you may know. He is also a historian, and moreover, he is a historian of Austrian history. This may surprise you, but the University of Chicago takes this risk to have a historian of Austrian history. And he is, in fact, one of the best experts in the late imperial history of the Habsburg Empire, and he has written very well-known books, especially on the Christian social party politics in this late imperial era. He will talk tonight about a subtopic of this Christian social politics, namely about Karl Lueger, one of the mayors of Vienna at the turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th century. Karl Lueger, a most prominent figure, and John Boyer asks the question whether Luegeran politics, as were done in Vienna, in the city of Vienna, at the turn of the century, were the foundations of modern politics, of how modern politics are done, at least in Central Europe. And I will ask you, John, just to start right away.
Thank you, Maggie. I want to begin by also thanking the our hosts at the Kepler Salon for their generosity in making available their program to us tonight, and I'm delighted that so many students from the University of Chicago and the Erasmus Mundus program could attend, coming from Vienna. I wanted to talk today I was invited to talk about Karl Lueger, the mayor of Vienna, probably the most famous mayor of Vienna, certainly before 1914. And I want to begin by just reminding you of a couple of salient facts that it seems to me are important in understanding him and also the role of Vienna in the late imperial Habsburg political system. If you take the span of his life, he was born in 1844, so 4 years before the revolution of 1848. He died in 1910, 4 years before the outbreak of World War I. So if you take the span of his life, roughly 1840s to World War I, there are some large, what one might call secular movements or secular trends which dominate Central European history. And in fact, one could argue dominate all of European history. The first is that throughout Central Europe, at least, the crown and conservative elites, the crown, and I mean the emperor, but also the emperor's whole political apparatus, is under considerable pressure, really beginning in the 1840s down to 1914, to extend systems of constitutional government, systems of liberal rights, systems of at least more flexible, if not actually democratic, electoral opportunities, franchise opportunities, voting opportunities to the people. And so the role of the crown is terribly important down to the First World War. It's a major factor in both German and in Habsburg political history. The second is that the people forcing the crown to try to make concessions to the people, the different different factions have different understandings of what the people is. We would broadly call them liberals. In France, perhaps we would call them the radicals, but liberals or national liberals or progressives, but liberals, people who more or less buy into the idea of a code of human rights or civil rights anchored in the Constitution, who buy into the idea of a political system to which, in which the crown is responsible to the elected representatives of the of at least part of the people, if not all the people, and a system in which control of the budget is really in the hands of Parliament, not in the hands of the crown. That these liberals are a second great political force in the course of the 19th century. In Germany, at least, they maintain a strong and central place in the role of German history, really down to the First World War. The third secular force that emerges in the 1880s and 1890s with increasing force and increasing aggressiveness is social democracy. The German social democracy, led by people like Bebel and Leibniz, and then eventually people like Kautsky and Rosa Luxemburg and Edward Bernstein and all of the different factions thereof, or Austrian social democracy, led by the great Austrian social democratic leader Victor Adler. And the social democrats really intend to attack both the crown, or challenge the crown and the liberals, for control of the political space and the political institutions the liberals had tried to put in place to restrict the authority of the crown. So here you have a kind of triad, the crown, the liberals, and the social democrats. And I think it's fair to say that one can understand a great deal of Central European history by understanding the interplay between these three great forces. Now, the man that I'm going to be talking about this evening had a fairly unique role in that he, in his capacity as mayor of Vienna, had the opportunity to attack all three of these institutions or political parties at one and the same time. He was one of the first to challenge the authority of the crown in a way that no one had really done in Austrian history before. He was a man who came very close to destroying the liberal tradition in Vienna. And he was a man who both challenged and in some ways gave life to and empowered in a kind of push and shove way the energy and the authority of Austrian social democracy. The social democrats, my argument is that they become a great party because they have a great opponent to fight, namely the Uyghur. I want to talk today in terms of, really in four parts. I want to say a little bit about, to remind you about the man, himself, his biography. I'd like to talk a little bit about the ethos of the movement that he founded up to 1914. I'd like to then talk about how certain strands of the movement play down to 1945 and how, in a way, the modern Austrian political system that we see in today really is a combination of original tendencies that start before 1914 but then are seriously modified over the interwar period, or the period of the First Republic, as it's usually called. And then I'll have some concluding remarks about why I think the story, this narrative, is of importance not only to Austrian historians but also to historians of European and perhaps even American history more generally. The first part, Uyghur the man. Uyghur was a native Viennese. He was born in the 4th district, Wieden. He grew up and made his political career in the 3rd district of Landstrasse. As I mentioned before, he was born in 1844, so that he is of that generation that did not experience the revolution of 1848, but who heard a great deal about it. And as he grew up in the 1850s, attending the Theresianum, this very distinguished gymnasium, which was a great privilege. He attended as an external student, as a non-residential student, but did well and was able to go to the university, graduating from the University of Vienna with a law degree in 1870, and conventionally would have entered the law, and he did enter the law, but decided he wanted to have a career in politics and began the kind of apprenticeship that any large city political operation requires. You start at the local district level and try to work your way up. This was a time when the liberals, the Austrian liberals, not only controlled the national government, having seized, as it were, seized power or seized a substantial share of power from the crown in 1867 and given Austria a constitution, but also they controlled the city government of Vienna. And Vienna is rather special from other large cities in Europe or America for a couple of reasons. First, it has a an elected mayor, is elected by the citizens or by the representatives of the citizens, and who has to be confirmed by the emperor, but who is not selected by the emperor, so that the mayor in Vienna is traditionally a politician, and increasingly a professional politician, not a civil servant, and which was the case largely in Germany, where the emperors were really what would call Beamte, a civil servant, a non-party political civil servant. So mayors in Vienna are political animals, whether they're liberals, Christian socials, or nowadays social democrats. And the certainly the current mayor of Vienna is an excellent politician, Michael Heupel, a political animal, and I mean that as a compliment. Coming from a city, Chicago, where we value and appreciate political animals. The second important thing to remember about Vienna is Vienna was an autonomous city. There are traditions of Austrian constitutional law provided for all of the large cities of the empire to have what were called Städteordnungen, ordinances or really city charters, which gave the city a great deal of autonomous power vis-a-vis the state. Now, in part, this was given to the city as a way of saving money, so you could have the city authorities do things that the state or imperial authorities didn't want to pay for. But again, unlike, say, France, where you have a rather similar kind of tumultuous politics in Paris, politics, the kind of politics I'll be alluding to in a minute, anti-Semitic politics, radical politics, the problem in Paris is Paris doesn't have a mayor. The office of the mayor is abolished in 1871, and Paris does not have the kind of autonomy as a municipal arena that Vienna does, because really the prefect of the Seine is the most important person in Paris in the French political system as it pertains to the governance of Paris. So in Vienna, and one could argue the same as in Prague and perhaps some of the smaller cities, maybe even Linz, one might argue, city politics are important because there's a realm of constitutional possibility, a realm of political reality, a realm of resources, a realm of independence, and a realm of just raw and naked political energy that can play out uncontrolled by imperial administrative elites, uncontrolled by tradition, uncontrolled by the higher civil service. Lueger tried to break into politics in the 1870s, and he quickly ran afoul of the mayor at the time, Kajetan Felder, who was a very distinguished and formidable mayor. Lueger eventually decided that he was going to break with Felder, which would be in the case of Chicago, it would be like an alderman deciding that he was going to be, instead of being a friend of Mayor Daley, being an enemy of Mayor Daley. And that's kind of like going into a political wilderness. All of a sudden, your telephone calls are not responded to. All of a sudden, the garbage in your ward is not picked up. All of a sudden, when it snows, the streets in your ward are not plowed. And so Lueger did this for reasons which are not altogether clear. I think he was a very man of great ambition and great impatience, great energy, but he took a great gamble, and he decided to go, as one might say, into the opposition. Of course, going into the opposition means that one has to, one can either go into a wilderness and stay there, or one can try to make out of the wilderness, out of the opposition, something which is meaningful in terms of advancing your career. And Lueger had the good fortune of finding in the civic terrain of Vienna in the 1880s a series of people who also didn't like the local liberal regime. He found a group of Catholic priests who, lower order priests, not the archbishop, but the kind of common clergy, who resented the anti-clericalism of the liberal regime, who resented the kind of insults that they perceived the liberal regime, the newspapers subjected the church. The Catholic Church, who really felt that the Vienna as a Catholic city, as a city which had been Catholic for centuries, had somehow been taken away from them by a regime that was anti-clerical and rationalistic and secular. And so you had that group. And then there were a group of artisans, handicraft people, small shopkeepers, small business people, who had who found themselves with increasing frustration trying to survive as the Industrial Revolution unfolded and as the negative consequences of the great crash of 1873, there had been something akin to the kind of political economic upheaval that we've experienced in the last year or two. As they tried to pull their lives together and increasingly found themselves living in a kind of situation of marginality and frustration and being worried about their families and about their careers. Angry people who were looking for a political alternative who thought that the liberal regime was not really interested in helping them. And then there were a whole group of other people, city school teachers, who felt that they deserved more salary level enhancements and who thought that the Mayor Felder and his successors were unsympathetic. And there were lower-level state officials who were frustrated with the way in which the civil government, the imperial government, was treating them. And there were even property owners who felt that they weren't getting the right kind of tax breaks. And so Lueger had, with a great deal of patience, and it's hard to know whether this was done with kind of deliberation and planning beforehand or whether he was just good on kind of turning on a dime and being able to react to a whole series of ad hoc possibilities as they came within his purview, within his kind of vision, was able to pull together over the course of the 1880s a coalition of dissident, unhappy people, and to infuse this coalition with a couple of kind of rhetorical tags and discursive fields. One and most prominent, and probably the one that for which Lueger is most has been longest remembered, is anti-Semitism. All over Central Europe in the 1880s, you find evidence of a revival of older anti-Judaism and a kind of newer anti-Semitism that is infused with economic distress and certainly pushed ahead by the anxiety of the Catholic clergy. You also find a rhetoric of nationalism. This is an age in which more and more the national problem is heating up in Austrian politics, and the national government is controlled by a coalition of forces, the Austrian liberals having lost control of the government in 1879, a coalition of forces that are dominated by Catholics, by Poles, by Czechs, by Catholic conservatives, and so that the city itself is seen to be increasingly surrounded by and governed by a government that is unsympathetic to at least to Vienna as a independent political universe. And Lueger adds all of these together in a kind of very carefully orchestrated coalition and basically fights his way into a great standoff battle with the liberal government, the city government, in the years 1895-96. He does this because, and he's able to do this, because Vienna's voting system is also very different from that of Paris or Chicago or New York or Berlin, for that matter, or Dresden or Munich or Cologne. In Vienna, you had a system in which voters were organized in curias. There were three curias, 1, 2, 3. The top curia was the wealthiest people. The middle curia were basically civil servants and school teachers and some less wealthy, but somewhat wealthy people. And then the third curia were people who were kind of handicraft artisans, the kind of lower Kleinbürger, the Mittelstand. Workers couldn't vote as they could in Paris. But the system itself and the details are very complicated, and you can read it in my first volume that Maggie referred to, more than you'll ever want to know about this subject, so I'm not going to go into it here. It's online. You can read it for free, actually. And you'll be able to read, I hope, a German version of this in the not-too-distant future to be published by Verlag early next year. But the point is that the political system itself, the way in which voters were allocated, gave Lueger an enormous advantage, because if he could capture the bottom curia, which was fairly easy to capture, and then get enough votes from disgruntled civil servants and teachers and kind of property owners in the second curia, he actually had a good chance of taking control of Vienna. And this is exactly what he does in 1895-96. He actually succeeds in a carefully orchestrated coalition of anti-Semitic rhetoric, promising things to a whole host of occupational groups that he probably had, in a way, had no way of delivering on, but that never stops politicians from making promises. And also a rhetoric of kind of Vienna first. It was time for the city of Vienna to take control of its own fate and for people to be in the city government who were going to protect it, really take care of it against the national regime, against all of the nefarious forces that were seen to be surrounding it. And Lueger actually gains sufficient votes to be elected mayor. And then a standoff occurs, a very powerful standoff. It's a complicated story, but he is actually elected, and the emperor refuses to sanction his election. And this creates a crisis. And the more voting is held, and he's again elected mayor, and eventually a solution is found whereby a straw man is put into place for a year to give the emperor basically a kind of safe-facing opportunity. A guy by the name of Josef Strawbach, and then a year later, in May of 1897, Loewiger is elected again, and he's finally confirmed as mayor. This is the first time, at least as far as I could tell, anywhere in Central Europe, that a popularly elected politician has forced an emperor to do his bidding. My own view is the emperor was outraged, the emperor was frustrated. In some ways, this was a repeat of 1848, and the outcome was not going to be the kind of outcome that the emperor wanted, namely to be able to crush or repress these kind of popular, highly populistic, demagogic, lower class or lower middle class forces. He had to give way. There was no option, and Loewiger is confirmed as mayor. So Karl Loewiger becomes the mayor of a city which will soon have 2 million people, is one of the wealthiest in Central Europe. And by virtue of the activities that he undertakes as mayor, he makes it an even wealthier city. The liberals who governed Vienna were absolutely certain that Loewiger would be elected, gain control of Vienna, and make such a big mess of it that he would kind of self-destruct or implode. In fact, he proved to be quite the opposite. He proved to be not only a skillful politician, but also a very effective manager. He's most known for municipalizing or communalizing, taking over, buying out privately owned utilities, gas, water, electricity, and turning them into city industries, a kind of not state capitalism, but a kind of city capitalism. And he did this, and in the various biographies one sees of him, this is always cited as, you know, one of the kind of positive features of his regime, the anti-Semitism and the kind of extremist rhetoric being the kind of negative sides of the man's biography. In fact, most German cities were actually moving toward municipalization. What Loewiger did actually was to accelerate the process. He did it very quickly, and he did it with a kind of panache and a kind of flair to get credit, both where credit was due and also to kind of give himself credit, beyond which he probably wasn't due, but he took it anyway. And these municipalized utilities gave the city an enormous source of new revenue. And revenue is important for a city, and any mayor will tell you that, whether it's the mayor of Linz or Vienna or Chicago, because revenue enables you to do two things. First of all, or three things, really. First of all, it enables you not to tax people more than, especially your own voters, more than you very much want. Second, it enables you to do other good things, to build bridges and to build schools and to do paved roads and to plan art galleries and do other things that you would want. And then thirdly, money it also enables you to pay salaries and to create a city bureaucracy and a city job force. Politicians love jobs because jobs lead to votes, and votes lead to more jobs. And so at least that's the way it worked in Chicago, and this is the way in which Loewiger fashioned it in Vienna. And by the end of his career, he is basically the second or third largest employer in the whole of the empire in terms of the number of jobs that actually he controlled or men who reported to him controlled. An enormous city workforce sitting on top of a city that is increasingly wealthy, powerful, increasingly much more important in terms of the imperial political system. And I'll come to that in a minute. As time goes on, the anti-Semitism runs in two directions, and I think we have to be candid about this and not kind of let it slip. He was elected on an anti-Semitic program it was implemented in at least in a couple ways that I've been able to discover. There was a systematic attempt to eliminate Jewish civil servants within the municipal bureaucracy. I've discovered a number of personnel files in which civil servants who were Jewish happened to come up for promotion, and they basically were told, you're not going to be promoted, you're going to stay where you are, other people would promote over you. And in fact, there was even suggested, I think, to many of them, you might just want to take your pension and retire, and we'll make it worthwhile to you to do so. I have to say that there weren't that many civil servants to begin with, and one of the things that the Christian Socials, which is the party that Loewiger, the official tag that Loewiger eventually gives his party, One of the things they often said about their liberal predecessors is that they, when they inherited power in 1897, what they were surprised by is how few Jews there were in the civil service, even under the liberals. But that's a different question. There was systematic discrimination against Jewish civil servants, and there was even more discrimination in terms of the award of contracts. At least in the first several years of the Weigert's regime, there was an attempt to channel contracts to firms owned by Gentiles or firms owned by people who were associated to the party. And since a lot of the commerce in the city, a lot of the business in the city was owned by Jews, this could be seen as being a discriminatory. It was a discriminatory factor. Over the course of the Weigert's career, a lot of this tends to get murky, and certainly by the time of his death, there are a lot of accusations within the party elite that he had gone soft, that in fact contracts were being given to Jews, that in fact he and many of his highest administrators really were—they might mouth anti-Semitic rhetoric, but they didn't really mean it. It is interesting that one of the points that Hitler makes in Mein Kampf about Christian social anti-Semitism, at least in the English translation, is that this was what Hitler called a sham anti-Semitism. It wasn't really meant seriously, and so forth. I think for the people involved, this was no less hurtful and no less outrageous, but it was a certainly by the time of Hitler of Weigert's death, the regime seemed to have come to terms with leading Jewish elites, and the formal anti-Semitic posture of the party had receded significantly into the background. Weigert dies in March 1910 he had long been suffering with diabetes and other ills, and he's buried to a buried. He's given a funeral worthy, I would say, of a monarch. And I'll come back to the theme of Weigert as a monarch at the end of my remarks. Okay, that's the man. Now, why was he important in terms of the movement that he founded? I think he becomes important really for a series of events that happen. Beginning in 1904, 1905, Austria, unlike France, unlike Britain in a relative sense, unlike Germany in a formal sense, Austria did not have universal mandate suffrage. Voting was still done by curias, and basically if you weren't a taxpayer or you didn't have a civil service job, you didn't get to vote. The Austrian Social Democrats, party of the Austrian Marxists or neo-Marxists or quasi-Marxists, they kind of several varieties of people within that movement and their attitudes toward Marx, pushed very hard. And you finally have a crisis in 1905 on the eve or just coterminous with the Russian Revolution, in which a great deal of pressure is brought on the emperor and the imperial civil service to grant universal suffrage. One of the things that is often not remembered is because oftentimes in the kind of narrative of the success of universal suffrage, the Austria does get the vote, all manhood suffrage by in 1907. This is usually credited to the Austrian Social Democrats, but actually the vote that those bills would never have gone through Parliament had not Weigert decided to put his faction's votes behind them as well. So that you have this very curious situation in which a party that began as a kind of a city party of Stadtbürger, Stadt with the D, not the double A, Stadtbürger, who see themselves as the kind of owners, the Eigentümer of Vienna, people who are proprietary owners of Vienna because they are taxpayers, because they are Hausbesitzer, because they are property elites, perhaps not as wealthy as the liberal elites, but they've managed by 1905 to co-opt many of those liberal elites into voting for them as well. A party that has succeeded the liberals, not only defeating it, but in some ways kind of cannibalizing many of its voters, becoming a kind of petty city patrician party. This party is now forced to make a decision as to whether it's going to take a 90-degree turn and vote to support universal manhood suffrage. And this caused a great deal of debate and discussion within the party elite. There were older, more conservative factions, and I have to say the more anti-Semitic factions that were totally opposed to doing this. There were other factions who saw that the future of the modern world lay in the movement toward universal suffrage, and that there were advantages to be gained because if one had a universal suffrage system, you might be able to link the Christian Social Party in Vienna up with the Catholic forces in Upper Austria, where we're sitting now, perhaps not in Linz, but certainly in rural Lower Austria, in Tyrol, in Salzburg, in Burgenland, in Vorarlberg, in German-speaking German parts of Styria, which were ready for a leadership coming from Vienna, and peasants voting, giving the peasants the vote wasn't dangerous because they would vote conservative and, or kind of Christian conservative anyway. There was a possibility that if one could imagine the creation of a Christian Democratic or a Christian Imperial Party modeled on the German Zentrumspartei, the center party in Imperial Germany, in which one would base the party in Vienna, but one would spread out into the Alpine provinces, into Upper Austria, into Styria, into Salzburg, into German-speaking Tyrol, and one could have a major movement, one could create a major imperial-wide party that would be much more powerful than any parties based in Vienna, and that would itself be then a worthy competitor of this great threat to the state, the Austrian Social Democrats. And this is exactly what Loewiger decides to do. I think he did it with great ambivalence and great uncertainty, but he decides to do it. And it's the decision of Loewiger and his lieutenants, Albert Gespen and Richard Weisskirchner, to support universal suffrage in 1905, leading to the passage of the bill in 1907, the first free elections under this new system that the empire had of universal suffrage occur in May of 1907, and the Christian Socials end up becoming the largest party in the Austrian parliament and the first freely elected parliament of, based upon universal suffrage. The second largest party were the Party of the Austrian Social Democrats. So this is one example. I could give others. This is a party that begins in Vienna, a party that begins in a small fragmentary coalition of dissidents, a party that moves up the scale by certainly the 1905, 1906. You have very wealthy people wanting to contribute to the party. That tends to happen with parties in power. All kinds of people with money and resources want to give you money to gain favor. A party that had proven that it could run Vienna. It could run Vienna as well as the liberals and perhaps even better. Many of the civil servants who were running Vienna under the Christian Socials had been hired as junior civil servants under the liberals, not Jews, but the Gentiles. And so you have a party that by 1914 seems poised to carry forward a kind of imperial defense. This is a party that's very loyal to the emperor. It's kind of ironic that having kind of defeated the emperor, Loewiger is then willing to become his best friend. Loewiger may have offered that. I think the emperor never really accepted that kind of relationship, but I think that's how Loewiger saw his relationship with the emperor. He was kind of the best emperor, the best thing that ever came along for the emperor in terms of defending the stability of the imperial state against the radical Czechs, radical social democrats, and radical German nationalists. What happens then is that, of course, World War I happens, and this idea of a Christian democratic, a Christian imperial Reichspartei, which was very plausible in the imperial system, becomes far less plausible under the Second Republic. And so a couple of things kind of go into this under the First Republic after 1918. And so I want to talk a little bit now in my third part of my comments about what happens to this tradition between the wars, because it's of great importance not only for Loewiger's image and his memory and understanding the man, but also for the how this shapes contemporary Austrian political structures. Three things happen to this tradition of a Christian democratic Reichspartei after 1918. Before 1914, the success of this party or of this concept was based upon the assumption that Vienna would always remain under Christian social rule. When Loewiger agreed to support universal suffrage in 1907, he knew that the Social Democrats would begin to win votes. He disliked that, but he never thought for a moment that his party would lose control of the Rathaus. Never for a moment. Never. And so because the whole logic of what he had done in winning power in 1897 and then in extending the power of his party in 1905 and 1907 to include the Alpine provinces this was a party that was to be based in Vienna. It was to operate out of Vienna. Vienna was to remain black, if one wants to use the kind of interwar coding, color coding, black as opposed to red. But of course, after 1919, exactly the opposite happens. And in May of 1919, the first municipal elections for Vienna are held after the collapse of the empire and the defeat of the the collapse of the dynasty, and the Christian Socials are bloodied and driven into a pitiful minority status. The Social Democrats take control of the city, and the city they take control of is an important city because Loewiger had made it important and made it really kind of worthwhile controlling. Because it was not only a city, but also, in a sense, it was a province. It was a land. And Vienna actually, after World War I, does become an official crown land or land. But that was simply following on these great traditions of autonomy and municipal power, I think, that Loewiger had built up before his death in 1910. In Vienna was so worth governing. Whatever your color, because of what the Christian Socials had built up into this enormous power base, and now it all ends up in the hands of the Social Democrats. And so, for the next 30 years, the Christian Social Party now has to kind of figure out how to be the kind of party Loewiger wanted, but without controlling the kind of head and the heart of the party, Vienna. And this is important for the putative successor who succeeds Loewiger as the head of the Christian Socials during the First Republic, Ignaz Seipel, who in his own way is a very notable kind of European statesman and a figure of much controversy and probably one of the smartest political figures, most intelligent political figures of his age, because Seipel, for all of the great things that he did, I think one has to be honest in saying that he hated the Social Democrats with a kind of visceral quality, kind of emotional quality, and I think that the day he died, he never acknowledged that the Social Democrats had the right to control Vienna. I think that this helps to explain his kind of playing with the Heimwehr's threatening always to march on Vienna, and I think that the Ständestaat that comes to power after the Austro-Fascist putsch in February of 1934 is not really is not fully understood unless one understands that the younger Christian Socials who are affiliated with Seipel, who come out of a much more Catholic orientation than Loewiger ever had, and I'll come back to that in a minute, for them, this is really an attempt to retake the blackness of Vienna, a Vienna that should never have been lost to the red, a Heiliges Wien, not a Rotes Wien. And so one has, and of course that's something that could never be sustained, and after World War II, the now renamed Christian Democratic Party, the AFAP, the People's Party, who are the heirs of the Christian Socials, even though there's a kind of complexity as to how they want to admit or acknowledge that heirship, they have to kind of come to terms with the fact that Vienna is not theirs anymore, and it will never be theirs. Down to the present day, it's not theirs. The second thing that happens during the war is something I just alluded to, is that there is a turn toward a much more Catholic profile of the party. Loewiger grew up in the liberal era. He himself was a man who came to terms with the Catholic Church. It was useful to him, I think, in a kind of general civic-minded way. He thought that the church was important. It was part of the aura of the dynasty, the aura of the regime. To be a good Catholic meant to be a loyal Habsburg citizen and also likely a Christian Social voter. And so that was enough for him. But there were limits to which he was willing to go, and it's very important that his rhetoric usually stressed Christian, not Catholic. Now, in part, that was about to the anti-Semites, who themselves, many of whom were not particularly Catholic. But it was also a kind of a bow to a kind of older tradition of what's sometimes called Josephinismus, a kind of state control of church, liberal control of church. And Loewiger was not a partisan, a deep felt partisan of Rome or the Vatican, in the way that his successors after 1919, especially in Vienna, Seipel, Richard Schmitz, Victor Kienbeck, a much more Catholic version of the party become. And this becomes something which the FLP has to give up after 1945, or really eventually gives up in part because the Catholic Church itself decides, as Maria Zell, in the famous Maria Zell Declaration in the early 50s, to take itself out of politics. It's not that Catholics don't vote for the FLP, but the Catholic Church is no longer an agent of Catholic politics, and the FLP is no longer a kind of a paid political agent of the Catholic Church. So that break occurs as well. And the third thing that happens is that when Loewiger decides to enter the national fray in 1905, it's important to remember that that the political system of the empire included Bohemia and Moravia, and German-speaking political Moravia, Silesia, Bohemia were represented by various ex-liberal factions. They called themselves Pan-Germans, German nationalists, various varieties. These were kind of bürgerlich groups, Kleinbürgerlich groups, who were neither social democrats nor Christian socials, but who in a pinch could usually be relied to vote bürgerlich, and so that the political world that Loewiger and his lieutenants imagined in 1907, there was no way in which they would ever be outnumbered by the social democrats, because there were always these larger bourgeois political groups in the Sudetenlands that could always be relied upon to control the government. And it's very clear that this is one of the reasons why there was a decision to support universal suffrage, because it would never be that dangerous. After 1919, Austria loses control of the Sudetenlands. It's fascinating. There are maps, they kind of begin in November and end sometime early in 1919, where you actually can see the German parts of Bohemia and Moravia as part of the Austrian Republic. There was this idea that somehow they would be able to keep control of those provinces, but of course the activity of the Czech paramilitary forces and the success of the Czechs at Versailles and Saint-Germain meant that the Austrians were not going to keep control of those provinces, and so that the Grossdeutsch faction, the German pan-German faction of Austrian politics, after 1920, instead of being a major player in Austrian politics, becomes a small rump faction, and basically big enough to give Ignaz Seipel the votes that he needed to control the Austrian government throughout the 20s, but not big enough to seriously challenge the Christian socials. And this becomes important after 1945, because after 1945, the Anschluss, again, is completely over, and the Christian Democrats, the FLP, not only have to get used to not having Vienna, not having a formally political Catholic apparatus with which to work, but they also have to get used to and profit from the fact that the Grossdeutsch faction, having become largely Nazi, at least for the first 10 years or so, don't come back into the political system, and so you end up with this fascinating condominium arrangement of the Republic after 1945 becoming the solely owned propriety of these two great parties, former imperial parties, the red and the black, with the pan-Germans totally excluded. Now, why is this, let me come to my concluding remarks, why is this important historically? Why was Loewiger's career important historically? I think it's a couple of things could be said. I think, first of all, I've alluded to the importance of a kind of rowdy, and if certainly if one were an imperial courtier or a high imperial civil servant, perhaps distasteful political movement taking control of a major European political city. This was a combination of a kind of noise on one level, but a kind of powerful social and political revolution on another level. One of the things that happens, and we know this more in historians of the empire, of the Habsburg Empire, historians of the German Empire, the Kaiserreich, have been kind of commenting on this, I'd say, much more in the last 10 to 15 years, is that there does begin to be a kind of realignment of politics, both in Germany and Austria-Hungary, or certainly the Austrian side of the empire, beginning in the 1890s, in which one not only has a kind of denser web of civil society, more people organizing on behalf of more causes, social democracy playing a much more threatening role now, challenging both the liberals and the crown. But one also has a kind of institutional revolution, a revolution in which cities and the crown lands by virtue of the just the growth in population, the growth in financial resources, the growth in the kind of responsibilities they were taking on for themselves begin to create a kind of a recalibration of the calculus of institutional power in the empire. And I think even if the liberals had maintained control of Vienna, this would have happened, but I think under Lueger and the very aggressive drumbeat of local autonomy coupled with the expansion of the city's financial portfolio, Lueger becomes a kind of leader of this very quiet institutional revolution in which the citizenry are slowly beginning to, and it is slowly, and it's hard to know how it would have played out if it would have accelerated in the way that it did had 1914, 1918 not happened. But there is this slow challenge, a slow and growing challenge to the imperial government, to the crown, to the imperial civil service on the part of elected civic elites, which in a way challenges the traditional theory of German and to a lesser extent Austrian history that Germany was somehow caught up in a Sonderweg, that the German bourgeoisie, the German civil society couldn't challenge the crown, and therefore you end up with all of the terrible things happening in the 1930s and 1940s because you tend to have a weak civil society, a weak government, a weak bourgeoisie, even a weak working class. And I think the example of Lueger and Vienna suggests that there are other ways of looking at this, that in fact that you did have people emerge with publicly legitimated, electorally grounded power who were willing to take on the crown and who could get away with it and win. So I think that's one thing that's important. I think a second thing which is very important is the fact that Lueger does end up basically destroying and cannibalizing the liberals. And so you end up, by 1914 in Vienna, with two parties contesting Vienna. It's not the liberals and the social and the Christian socials. It's the liberals and the social democrats. Hermann Broch, the great Austrian writer, in his wonderful book on Hoffmannsthal and his time, has this wonderful formulation of Lueger and Victor Adler as running an international, and he uses the international almost as like, you know, it's like the Roman international. These two great internationals, the Social Democratic International and now the Christian International, internationals like the Third International or the, you know, the Vatican bureaucracy. If you think about 1914, you think about 1919, think about 1945, Vienna becomes the cockpit for the conflict of these two great internationals with no other intervening forces. Unlike Berlin, which after the war is governed by a series of arrangements between the Social Democrats and various liberal forces, unlike the Weimar Republic, which is governed by a series of agreements between liberals and Catholic center party politicians and the more right-wing Social Democrats, in Austria you end up with these two great Lager, these two great camps that really come out of the Lueger period. The Christian socials, in a sense, not only make themselves great, but in a way I think they make the Social Democrats great by giving the Social Democrats an opponent worthy of being a great Social Democrat. And so that the traces of Lueger's accomplishments and his ferocious style of politics have a very long reach deep into the 20th century. Let me conclude by just reading a passage from Felix Salten, who was a rather famous Austrian, I think probably very famous, right? Very famous Austrian writer, who I think despised Lueger, or at least strongly disliked him. Writes of him, though, he was no admirer of him. This is in the context of how to think about Lueger as today. In a way, one might argue that the early FVP leaders of the Second Republic, someone like Fiegel or Julius Raab, are more like the kind of pragmatic urban politician that Lueger represented, obviously minus the anti-Semitism, than someone like Zeipel, who a much more doctrinaire ideologist. But the distance that runs between a Loegger and a Figaro Rob is so enormous. Loegger, the ruler of this 2 million city, a city of enormous wealth and growing wealth, projections that it would grow to 4 million people by the middle of the 20th century, enormous wealth, a city which is the capital of this great multinational empire, which was not about to fall apart in 1913. Thomas Masaryk and others later notwithstanding, it was not about just to collapse. To compare that world with the world that Figel and Rob had to inherit in this kind of small, impoverished Austrian state in which the both they and their social democratic counterparts become defenders of the kind of residue of the imperial Reichsstadt, because they're not only, I think they both agreed that the Reichsstadt, the state of law, was important, but what options did they have except to agree to defend the Reichsstadt? And Salthin writes of Loegger that he says the following, nun hat, and this is in German, nun hat er Wien aufgerichtet als eine Art von Königreich mitten in Österreich, die Stadt, die so viele Betriebe in ihrer Hand hält, höchst über eine Armee von Dienern, Arbeitern, Beamten, Lehrern, Ärzten, Professoren, höchst durch tausendfach verknüpfte Interessen weithin über die Gesinnungen und Ahlen. Und Ahlen ist der Bürgermeister, und Ahlen ist der Bürgermeister, von dem sie anhängen wie ein Monarch. Wie ein Monarch. Loegger as the monarch of this army of servants and teachers and civil servants and who basically were loyal to him, and as any modern big city mayor would expect loyalty. And I would say that in thinking about Loegger's life, that this was a life of, it was a 19th century adventure. It's important to remember he died in 1910. This was a 19th century man. This was a life of 19th century political adventure. It was filled with the air of modernizing ambition, a kind of rough and tumble urban politics, a kind of a politics that at every turn exudes a confidence in the wealth of the empire and the material prosperity of Vienna, combined with, in the case of the man himself, enormous pride, egotism, a kind of ruthlessness, at times even viciousness, but self-assertiveness. And I think that if Salatin said that, I think rightly, that Loegger ruled Vienna as a monarch would rule the empire, it's difficult to imagine him surviving in the what might call the thinner era of the First Republic. And so in some ways I think it's fitting that he died in 1910, because he's not a person who would have lived well in that more constrained set of circumstances. So those are my remarks, and if they have anything to do with this topic, it's perhaps slightly more than accidental. But
I'm absolutely convinced that they have something to do. We have some time for questions and comments, and I heartily invite you to ask questions or to comment on several points which came up in the lecture by John Boyer. Yes.
This is being recorded.
Thank you.
It's your 15 minutes of fame. So.
You said that Loegger was one of the first people who was able to take on the monarch and essentially get his way, an elected official. Do you think that, and that we kind of view what happens later with the crumbling of the empire as almost inevitable, and I was wondering if you thought this was a symptom of the decay of the empire or something that was to lead to the eventual decomposition?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I think the if you imagine the both of the Central European empires, I mean, setting Russia aside as kind of the three big losers of 1918, Russia, Germany, and Austria-Hungary, that in both cases, in the case of Germany, the Imperial Germany and the Habsburg Empire, if we take as a kind of modernity of the 20th century, or at least as a teleology toward which some it's plausible to assume that everyone would have to move in this direction. The idea that today we would find in this part of the world an emperor who would have total power or really uncontrolled power, we would find that kind of anachronistic. Now, I suppose it's possible to imagine this part of the world still living under those political circumstances, but I find it hard to actually assume for a whole variety of reasons that that would be the case. I think that this is was a very long learning process, and it was a process, a learning process on the part of the emperor and the part of the high civil bureaucracy of the empire, to learn to deal with local government officials, regional government officials as representatives of voters and not as simply their servants or their spokesmen for the views of the central ministries or the crown. And I think the fact that Loewiger was able to challenge the emperor and then was able to undertake a whole series of initiatives, one of which, just to mention one, when he began this process of trying to buy out the gasworks in Vanna Rome by private investors, the initial reaction on the part of the finance ministry was, well, you know, this is a terrible thing. We can't allow this. They're going to bungle it, and basically forcing the hand of the national government to actually sign the bill to authorize this. But by 1908, 1910, one finds comments from the finance ministry saying, well, actually, you know, they didn't bungle it. In fact, they're making a lot of money off of this. Maybe we should encourage them to do more of it, so that there is this kind of arc of what we call a learning process. That said, I think the knowing who the putative successor of Franz Josef was the First World War didn't happen. That really meant that Franz Ferdinand was going to succeed, who was an even greater autocrat than his predecessor, Franz Josef, or would have been a greater autocrat. And so I think that one way of answering your question is that Austria would have needed many more Loewigers in its future, strong political and administrative leaders, and those are not really a dime a dozen in any political system.
Let me ask one question. You had in your interpretation this point that it was Karl Loewiger and his Viennese party in the first place that made social democracy great, mm-hmm. by giving them a worthy opponent, so to mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. What about the question that social democracy became a Viennese party in this respect?
I think it did, and in a way, one could argue that the great treatise on the nationality question by Otto Bauer and the kind of somewhat great treatises by Karl Renner are both kind of highly Vienna-centric enterprises, and so that it's not simply the case that Adler's generation, in a sense, is influenced by Loewiger, but I think it's the next generation of the people who really become the Austro-Marxist practitioners are affected. I think it's very important to remember that both of these parties thought that they could control Vienna. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, only one party can control Vienna, and so you have this kind of deadlock and the kind of ruthlessness and the kind of bitterness and the kind of heightened political rhetoric and the kind of management skills to organize politically. I think that the cadre organizations and the kind of block clubs and all of the things for which the social democrats become very efficient, it's almost like a process of exercising. Mm-hmm. They develop these fighting Loewiger and Loewiger's minions. At the same time, you find the younger Christian socials deciding that they want more of that as well, and one place they can find more of it is in the organization of the church, the structure of the church, so that there's a tendency to kind of go deeper into the organizational realms of the church. I think we've lost sight of this now because since 1919, with the hiatus of 1934 to 45, Vienna has been a red bastion, and so we just think of it as it's not simply, it has nothing to do. I mean, obviously, the APA, People's Party headquarters are here, and you have significant, you have people like Hahn, but or not for long, but you have an APA faction in the city parliament and so forth. But Vienna is a red city, and so the idea that this was once a city in which both of these great parties thought that they had a chance to control, and in fact, it was their fate to control, and that the control of Vienna would then determine the way in which they controlled the rest of the empire. I think this has somehow been lost as part of the kind of disinterest in imperial history. There's been a kind of writing off of the history of the empire in a way that I find kind of peculiar and strange, which hopefully more Austrian and foreign historians will kind of go back to the empire as a source of serious political research in political, social, and cultural history.
I had another question about Luegger's relationship with the empire. Namely, you mentioned that after his party gained dominance and really did have control of the city, he nonetheless was really quite friendly to the emperor, despite the fact that the emperor was never really very friendly to him. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about his motivations for that, sort of friendship, or at least he was hospitable to empire interests.
I think in the there was a imperial governor, the governor of Lower Austria, his German was Stadthalter, Erich Kielmansegg, and Kielmansegg was a figure of considerable political weight in his own right, and in his memoirs, which were published after the Second World War, he describes this phenomenon of Luegger's wanting to kind of not show up the emperor, but in a way, you can imagine the emperor is the kind of person, because emperor should be this kind of person, that when he's in the room, all eyes go to the emperor, and that when Luegger walks in the room, people shouldn't start looking over to Luegger, but of course that's exactly what they did. So it's the idea of, it's the image of, can you have more than one emperor? Or put differently, can you have too many emperors? And I think there was nothing to be gained, and I think conceptually and personality-wise, Luegger realized that he was part of an era in which deference was shown to the emperor, just as people show deference to people in the White House today, whatever the party is. But it galled him. We know from a later commentary by one of his great political opponents, Karl Zeitz, who becomes a socialist mayor at the end of the 20s. Luegger once told Zeitz, I go to these dinners at the Hofburg, and because of the seating arrangements, we're all by a certain level of rank, and they put me way down at the end with the brigadier generals. And the emperor and these cretins, these archdukes who are witless, who elected them archduke, okay? Why do they get to sit down there, and I'm the mayor of Vienna? And I think that there were, on many occasions, he did not take great pains to contain that sensibility, and so that there was this ongoing tension. Part of it was his vanity, and he was a very vain person and ambitious person. But I think there was also a sense that, as a great successful person who had been elected mayor a number of times, and who probably had to do things which most of the men around the emperor had never done and could never do themselves, that he deserved more respect. And I think the emperor found that to be annoying and frustrating, as emperors probably would back in an era when at least this particular emperor, who was used to having his will with firing ministers at will. Franz Josef used to run through ministers, not a mile a minute, but there were, he went through a lot of them, but he couldn't get rid of Luegger because Luegger was elected by the people. He wasn't appointed by the emperor king.
I was wondering if you can comment a little bit on the youth of a society and how Luger's ideas influenced them, and well, from the very beginning, and how this changed, and how they would play perhaps a stronger role in society and politics, or perhaps a weaker one, according to how they changed.
It's an interesting problem in the sense that you have in the 1890s and 1900s the beginnings of youth movements, people organizing themselves and thinking about themselves as young people. And in the course that we teach, in which the Chicago students are participating, we have a document in, that I always give the students to read. It's called the Young People of Today, which is a survey that a couple of Parisian students did of the opinion of their fellow university students at the Sorbonne in 1911, 1912. And what they found, or at least what they allegedly found, was that these young people had totally different political attitudes from their parents. They were much more nationalistic, much more pro-Catholic than the anti-clerical civic elites of the Third Republic. As one begins to look around the terrain of Central Europe, I think you begin to find similar tendencies. And it works out, at least in Luger's party, in a curious way, because there were always people within the party who thought that the way in which you would get ahead was to be the son of a house visitor, the son of a property owner. And there were actually clubs called Jungherren clubs that were kind of young Democrats, young Republican type clubs, in which you would be, if you earned your spurs, put in your time, that eventually you might be slated to become a district level a director or whatever, and that the politics as such would continue to, young people would be respected, but they would be respected by being allowed to become old people and then become powerful. It's the more Catholic side of the party, people who eventually come to support Zipel, who actually believe that younger people should be heard right away. And the key figure here is this guy, a fellow by the name of Richard Schmitz, who becomes very important in the First Republic. He is the kind of Austro-fascist burgermeister who takes over from Seitz in 1934, who is a very young militant Catholic before World War I, and who really wants to, who sees many of the older politicians in his party as being really kind of not only too conservative, not anti-Semitic enough, not rigidly Catholic enough, but also as being too self-satisfied, as not being aggressive enough in fighting the Social Democrats. And I think probably if one looked over on the Social Democratic side of affairs, you'd find similar tendencies of youth pushing against their elders. And then, of course, World War I intervenes, and a lot of these youth are killed on the battlefield or paralyzed emotionally. But the youth movements do resume after World War I. And in the Catholic tradition, there's a movement called the Neuland tradition, which is very important. It hasn't been studied very much, of kind of Catholic youth movements that, again, feed in partly to the Ständestadt and then partly through people like Otto Maurer to Maria Zell and to the separation of church from party politics after World War II.
Other more questions or comments? I think that this kind of communalization or municipalization of services is the most important thing, and it's not something extraordinary for Luger to do this, because other cities do it at the very same time,
right,
to in some kind also nationalize these industries. In Vienna, I think the streetcars were in British hands before, and they were taken over by Vienna and thus made Austrian,
right,
things like that. I wonder why it took the imperial government so long to see advantages of such a politic?
My own view is that because, as you say, this tendency toward municipalization was moving ahead in many of the bigger German cities, that even if the liberal regime had remained in power, that they would have done the same thing. I think they would have gotten a lot less political credit for it. I think there are a couple of explanations. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure I have a good or final answer. I think that in a way, Vienna becomes a kind of forgotten city on the part of the imperial government, especially after 1879 with the shift to the Iron Ring. And it becomes a place that in a sense, you contain the dissidents, the labor unrest, and so forth. You might provide the kind of social legislation that you have written about much of your work. But the idea of seeing the city as an opportunity to invest in, to take risks in, because there was a risk, is that, well, perhaps it's just, it's not worth it, or we don't have to do it this year. We'll just kind of muddle along. And I think Lueger was elected mayor on a campaign of doing this, but I think it very quickly dawned on him and his advisors, especially the advisors in the city government, the city administration, most of whom had been trained by the liberals, that there was money to be had. And I think that once they knew that there were jobs, there was revenue, that this was just something they were going to go for. And it was owing to Lueger's kind of theatrical flair that he could make something that was fairly quotidian and that other governments were just doing as a matter of reasonably good policy seemed to be some kind of heroic victory, which he did.
Yeah. Okay. Final question from me. Are there questions left?
I think everybody is hungry, so we should...
I suppose, yes.
So thank you very much for your attention. Yeah. And
Thank you.